Dads on the air, we're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Simon Sawyer. Simon was appointed the Chief Executive Officer of Mates for Mates in 2015, after 26 years in the Royal Australian Air Force. During his time in the RAAF, Simon was deployed for operational service in Kuwait, East Timor and Afghanistan. Simon was recognised as a member of the Order of Australia in 2010 and awarded the Conspicuous Service Cross in 2006. Simon also holds a Master's in Management. Simon, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Simon, Mates for Mates began in 2013, and I have a vision of a military mate being someone like the soldiers depicted in that famous Cobbers statue in Fromelles in France on the Western Front. How do you see Mates for Mates?
Well, as you alluded, Mates was created in early 2013 as an initiative of the RSL here in Queensland. And we provide support to any current or former member of the Australian Defence Force who is wounded, injured or ill as a result of their service. So when I think of what that means and what that reflects, that could be anyone from the age of sort of 19 through to 80 or older even, but let's say 80, let's say the sort of 75, 80 year old Vietnam vets. It could be male or female, but it could also be the immediate family of those veterans. So one of the unique things about what we do when we provide our support to a wounded, injured or a veteran is where it's obvious that supporting the family will also help the veteran, then that's what we do.
And so far as the veterans are concerned, is this sometimes doubling up on the work that's done already by the DVA, Department of Veteran Affairs?
In essence, no. And the reason I hold on that answer is because we will provide that support across the board and we provide that support immediately. And sometimes what happens, unfortunately, is the approval process can take some time. And then what DVA is actually funded and authorised to provide might only be a component. So, for example, we provide physical support, physical training support, psychological services support, employment and education, our rehabilitation adventure challenges, and social engagement. With the psychological support, we actually do that essentially as a subcontractor of DVA, and we would bill DVA for that service. So we won't double up. We will work in consultation with, because it's all about finding out the best outcome and the best way of providing support for the veterans and their families.
Yeah, this whole area of veteran support is very much in the news at the moment. And what frequently seems to come out is that the veterans feel the department is a bit adversarial and they really have to fight for what should be their rights as benefits. Is that something you have to deal with?
We don't get involved in the claims process. So one of the services we don't do is what's called advocacy. We leave that to a number of other of the ex-service organisations, particularly the RSL. So in each of our three centres, we have RSL Queensland in the case of Brisbane and Townsville, and RSL Tasmania in the case of Hobart. We have an RSL advocate that will help the individual veteran lodge their claim with DVA. We do, unfortunately, hear some horror stories about the claims process, and that's about getting that acceptance of liability. But having said that, that's where the latest federal budget was quite pleasing, because DVA is getting $350 million extra, of which $166 million is to help them modernise their IT and fix that claims process. So in some of those cases of delay and I don't know whether adversarial is the right term. I mean, I'm sure that from the veteran's perspective, it may well feel that way. But sometimes that's just a matter of the staff not having enough latitude or even training. And that's the sort of thing that DVA may want to fix. And we've been involved in a number of conversations across the board with DVA and do find them wanting to help. It's just whether they've actually had systems in place to allow them to do that.
What are the requirements in order to get Mates for Mates on your side? Do you have any qualification requirements?
Essentially, the individual would come to us and want to become a member of Mates for Mates. So we do have an application process, and that's just about getting a brief understanding of what the person's military service was. And that's more about just confirming that they have served and that they can, that we can confirm that, that their wounded, injured or ill status was a result of their service. Now, we don't need medical certificates. We don't need a burden of proof the way, say, a claim with DVA would need to be. Ours is more on the balance of probabilities, and the psychologist will conduct those interviews to also just confirm where the person's at in their recovery process and what we can actually do to help them, because when we bring them in, we want to actually be able to help them. And if for some reason we can't, we need to explain why that is the case or what it is, how we think we'd be able to help them, so that they actually have an individual program. So whilst in its simplest form, it could just be coming to some of our barbecues or a cycling activity or some form of social engagement. In the more complex cases, it may well be regular psychological counselling, getting back to potentially some employment, some education, upskilling of education and certification of training, to then try them, ideally find them a job as well. So it really is a case-by-case assessment. But as far as that qualification of how they come in the door, just either still be serving or have served in the Australian Defence Force and be able to say that they're wounded, injured or ill as a result of their service.
And the majority of the people that come to see you, I'm not sure if you call them clients, but those people that come and ask for your assistance, are they young men usually?
So we refer to them as mates and then the family as family members. Well, the original intent when we were set up, the perception was that they would be, that we were going to get inundated with Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And whilst we have a number of those, interestingly enough, we have a lot of Vietnam veterans, we have a lot of East Timor veterans, and we also have a bunch of people that have never deployed overseas at all. So the thing people forget is that, well, what makes a lot of publicity is those that have had the misfortune of that military contact and operations, have been blown up overseas, shot out, involved in an aircraft accident, and that's all the arguably high profile, but it's the more obvious. What people sometimes forget about is what happens back here in Australia. In the simplest form, a training accident, a vehicle accident, which could be quite traumatic for someone, or result in a significant physical injury. And then in the most, probably more unusual, but still occur, if you're third generation wanting to join the army and you're at Kapuka and you're 6 weeks in and you get a traumatic shoulder injury that means you can't remain in the army, some people struggle to understand what that means for their life. If all they've ever wanted to do is join the army, they could be 3 or 4 years down track and have never had that psychological support to help manage and deal with that situation. So we'll help anyone that has served, and it doesn't matter where or how they got that condition associated with their military service. It's all about providing help when they need it.
And with the influx of females into the armed services, I guess you're getting a fair share of females as well.
We do. Currently, our figures are quite similar to that of the ADF. So we're about 85% male, 15% female. And right now on our books, we've got about 1,700 mates and another 1,700 family members. And that's from across the country, but the vast majority are obviously here in Queensland, and then the bigger portion of that is southeast Queensland, which is also no surprise given that it's the biggest discharge location as people get out of the military over the last sort of 10 years.
And the women are mates as well, I take it?
They are. No, they definitely are. We run a range of activities. The odd activity will be, if you like, single sex, but the majority are all just mates activities. And then we do have some activities that we target for the mate and their partner, whichever way that combination might work, female mate with male partner or male mate with female partner or otherwise.
And we're speaking today with Simon Sawyer, who is the CEO of Mates for Mates, supporting injured Defence Force mates. We're going to take a short break now. We're going to listen to a poem this time, and it's called The Lanes of Woolloomooloo, and it's by a late well-known Australian folk singer and poet called John Dengate.
The Lanes of Woolloomooloo. Oh, then who's your mate, me Johnny lad, so drunk he can hardly stand, with his eyeballs staring so wildly and his violently shaking hand? Oh, his name is not for the naming, but his story I'll tell you true. He's a child of the Great Depression from the lanes of Woolloomooloo. He was reared on bread and dripping and on dollops of Dole plum jam. He dodged the police and his father's boot and his fare on the city tram. He mustered in the militia on the wharves of Woolloomooloo. He fought disease and the Japanese in the summer of 42. Ah, never you mind his shaking hand or his strangely twisted mouth. He was cut off at Templeton's Crossing when the Japs came swarming south. He wept and he prayed in the jungle, and God to his prayers was deaf. It was Choco, retreat on your bleeding feet. And where was the AIF? You'll find him now in Bell's Hotel, or round by the Domain. You'll find him under a Moreton Bay, sleeping it off in the rain. You'll find him wandering William Street, without any work to do. He's a child of the Great Depression, from the lanes of Woolloomooloo. He's a hollow, dirty derelict, abandoned by the fates. He souls at Templeton's Crossing with his dead militia mates. White Lady is his mistress. They fornicate and woo, spawning blind oblivion in the lanes of Woolloomooloo.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And that was Lanes of Woolloomooloo by John Dengate. And we're speaking today with Simon Sawyer, who is the CEO of Mates for Mates, and they provide support for injured Defence Force mates. So, Simon, we were talking about some of the people that come and see you and seek the services of Mates for Mates. Since you started in July 2015 as CEO, have you had any surprises?
I think, to be honest, the biggest surprise that probably affected me was when someone I know personally walks through the door. Obviously, the military is a pretty big military. I mean, and there's, having said that, it's not that big either. And a lot of the people we help, when you start talking to them, you've got mutual friends. But in a number of instances, probably half a dozen, I've had people walk through the door for help that I would have been reasonably close with throughout my service career. And that sort of just, I guess, reinforces to me, when it becomes firsthand, it really reinforces the importance. And it's not that wasn't there already, because you don't get into this environment, you don't work in this field if you don't want to help, and that sense of satisfaction is just incredible. But when you then realise that it's actually someone that you know, and you don't just know that little bit about their story, you know a lot about their story, sort of it just resonates that it's just a wonderful thing we do. It's a shame there's a requirement for it in the first place, but that's the reality of human nature. When we talk particularly about psychological stuff, the term we use is that things like PTSD are a normal response to an abnormal situation. So if we were all built being able to cope with that, then the world wouldn't necessarily be a very nice place, because we'd all be happy doing horrible things. So the fact that we do respond the way we do, and that the body has a response and the mind has a response that needs a bit of support afterwards, it's nice to be part of an organisation that provides that support.
Yes, you are doing that wonderful work with those veterans who we all admire. How many veterans are you actually treating at the moment?
So I mentioned earlier about 1,700 that are on our books. There's a percentage of those that you would argue are, for want of a better term, graduates of the program. They might have come on the books a couple of years ago when we started. They've had some support, and they've now got work and are moving on with their life in a meaningful, gainful way. And then there's a percentage that are more high intensity or high demand. They might be seeing a psych more regularly, attending a lot of the regular physical training classes, et cetera, and doing some of our other programs. And then there's probably the majority, or probably half of that number, that are more intermittent, that are generally okay and are generally coping, but occasionally they just want to be able to jump back into that military family type environment, come to one of our barbecues, have a conversation, talk about some of their old military reflections with people that just understand, that have been in that situation before, and it just helps them keep their sense of balance and keep their mind focused. And then they always know that if they want to come in and get a bit more support, they can. It's an as-needs required sort of approach. So it really is about the individual drawing from us. And one of the things that actually is really refreshing and positive to see is, for example, in the case of cycling, we had a couple of the mates that we put on a cycling event. And when they came back, they wanted to give back to us. So they essentially formed the nucleus of our cycling club. And so you end up with a number of the mates coordinating each weekly rides for the other mates. And there's no official staff involvement or no direct staff involvement, which is just a good positive sign that these guys and girls who have been highly performing individuals earlier in their career, for whatever reason, they've not been able to continue to operate that way, but they start getting some of that discipline and determination and dedication back into their life.
So for someone that walks through the door, you've got an injured serviceman, is there any cost to him, any fee?
No, there is not. A couple of the small minor activities might have more of a token cost, but when it comes to doing the main activities, when it comes to attending the gym or seeing the psychologist, there is no direct cost. I mentioned earlier, in the case of the exercise, in case of the psychologist, but also exercise physiologists, we are in the process where we're commencing, they would use their DVA white card to be able to bill DVA, so we can then, as a charity, we can then recoup money from DVA, but there's no out-of-pocket expense to the mates or to their family, because in the case of the family, obviously, we can link up with Medicare as well.
Yes, and we're speaking today with Simon Sawyer from Mates for Mates. Simon, suicide is a soaring concern for ex-servicemen, particularly the young soldiers. But the figures seem to indicate that when personnel are still serving, they're less likely to kill themselves than the community average. Any thoughts on why that might be?
Oh, I think, and you're talking about some study results that were released at the end of last year, which is about the only actual data we have. Otherwise, there's a lot of speculation out there, but this was some data that was done from 2001 to 2014, and we're waiting for the 2015 figures to be added to that. But I think when people are serving, they are focused, there is the mission, they are in a close working environment, they've got that military family, that military bond, and they have good access to a support network. When they leave the service, and we try and catch these guys and girls before they leave so that they're used to coming to us, because sometimes what will happen is they will want to have a break, and they'll want to chill, they want to disconnect from social media, they want to just have a bit of a break from the hustle and bustle of life, which is okay, we all need some downtime from time to time. But if that 1 week offline turns into a month, turns into 6 months offline, and they have socially isolated themselves to the point where they never leave the house, are lucky to talk to their family, just watch daytime television, don't actually want to interact, that's when the dangers and all that support network has broken down, and that's where those dangers for leading into suicide can really trigger.
Yes, I mean, one of the triggers in the general community is when, say, these sportsmen we're hearing about at the moment, when they leave something that has occupied their whole life for a considerable period and they suddenly find themselves without it, it creates that enormous stress. And I imagine in the army, where you've got those other factors you mentioned, the social side and the common purpose and the important mission and all those things, it just amplifies the problems.
Watched a number of those documentary type shows that have been on over the last few weeks regarding the elite sort of sports level, and not saying every single military person is elite, but in some regard they are in their own way because of the focus and the training and the ability to focus on the mission and being busy and always having something to do, and the parallels are quite scary really. There's a lot we could learn by having both these groups of people do more interaction together.
I mean, we always hear that the veterans won't talk about, you know, what happened in the war, even to their own families. Do you think it is better for them to talk about openly about what happened?
I think it's about balance. I think they need to do some talking, but in some instances, if talking is going to dredge up memories that are just too graphic, that it forces them to relive, that's where some of the counselling obviously helps to allow them to manage the physical and emotional response to some of those memories. But some of these guys and girls have been through some stuff that they don't really want to repeat, and the family don't really, they might think they want to know, but they don't want to know the gory details, so to speak. So it's about working out where the balance is, and that balance will adjust. So when we look at some of our mates that we use at speaking engagements, when we're out talking to community groups and everything, initially they won't want to talk at all. And one of the, I guess, the visual and physical definitions of success is they get more comfortable talking about what's happened to them. We never expect them to go beyond that level of comfort, and we never expect them to talk about the real graphic details. But to be able to say they were in a situation where they were shot at and talk about the generics of that, or the vehicle being blown up, or the vehicle accident and it was back in Australia, then that, I think, is actually helpful and healthy to help them get to that point where they can comfortably have that conversation and not have it impact them every time they say it.
Now, Simon, you mentioned the Queensland RSL. Where does Mates for Mates get its funding from?
So we were established by the Queensland RSL, and we're still majority funded by Queensland RSL. We do rely on other donations from the general public, and also a couple of corporate sponsors, and we're always actively looking for to get more income through those general donations and additional corporate sponsors. But right now, about 75% to 80% of our operating budget comes from the Queensland RSL.
So for anyone that wants to help in this very worthy cause, if you go to the website Mates for Mates, I think you'll find all the information there. So, Simon, we've reached the stage of the show where we ask our guests to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which song you picked and why you picked it?
Yeah, so I've picked the song called The Dust of Uruzgan by Fred Smith. Fred is known as the singing diplomat, and Fred and I were actually in Tarancot Air Base in Uruzgan province in the second half of 2013. It was my first and only deployment to Afghanistan, but I was privileged enough to be the base commander for that last 6 months with the withdrawal of Australian forces out of Tarancot. Fred was, I think he'd been there two or three times at that stage, but we met each other then. This song already had been released at this stage, but it wasn't until I came to Mates for Mates that I then realised that the song is actually about a guy by the name of Paul Warren, who is one of my staff members. Paul is a liaison officer working for Mates for Mates in Townsville, and does a lot of great work working with that, particularly the still-serving army guys up there, but also those that have left. And so it's a song that to me reflects everything about those recent campaigns and about what we're trying to achieve and what we do. So that's why I came up with that particular song.
In the ring they call me Warlord, my mother called me Paul. You can call me Private Warren when you file on your report. As to how I came to be here, this is what I understand. In this hospital in Germany, from the dust of Uruzgan. I had just turned 28, just bought a new car. When I joined the 1st Battalion at the big one RAR, we were next up for deployment into South Afghanistan to combat the insurgents in the dust of Uruzgan. It took 7 months of training just to get into the joint. There were push-ups and procedures, there was death by PowerPoint. From the RSO and I course there in Ali al-Salam, but nothing can prepare you for the dust of Uruzgan. Me and Benny sat together flying into Kandahar, suck back on our near beers in the camp vacant bar. Then we're up at 05:30 and on the Hurricane out. 20 flying minutes we're in Tarancot. We shook hands as the boys ripped out from MRTF1, and pretty soon we're out patrolling in the Afghan summer sun. Walking through the green zones with a star in my hand, body armor chafing through the dust of Uruzgan. We started up in Shora working 14 hours a day, mentoring a Kandak from the Afghan 4th Brigade. Down through the Baluchi into eastern Dorishan, working under open skies in the dust of Uruzgan. Well, it's a long, long way from Townsville, not like any place you'll see. Suddenly you're walking through the 14th century. Women under burkas, tribal warlords rule a land full of goats and huts and jingle trucks of the dust of Uhura's gang. And the education minister can neither read nor write, and the minister for women runs a knock shop there at night. They've been fighting there forever over water, food and land, murdering each other in the dust of Uhura's gang. Still the people can be gracious, and they're funny and they're smart. And when the children look into your eyes, they walk into your heart. Face each day with courage, and each year without a plan, beyond scratching for survival in the dust of Uhura's gang. But the Taliban are ruthless, keeping people terrorized, with roadside bombs and hangings and leaving letters in the night. And they have no useful vision for the children of this land, but to keep them praying on their knees in the dust of Uhura's gang. It was a quiet Saturday morning when the two shop made a call on a compound of interest to the east of Cotton Shore. We had some information. They were building IEDs, so we cordoned and we searched it in accord with SOPs. I was on the west flank picket, propped there with Ben, there to keep a watchful eye out while the other blokes went in. We knew what to look for from the TTPs we'd learned, but the Nationals were moving back and forth without concern. I've been standing still for hours when I took a quick step back.
And that was Dust of Uruzgan by Fred Smith, and there's a real story behind that song, as our guest today, Simon Sawyer, has just explained to us, with the central character actually working for Mates for Mates. And that is another story. And it's a book too, Dust of Uruzgan by Fred Smith. We've come to the end of the show. It's just great hearing all this wonderful work you're doing, Simon. If anyone would like to listen to this show again, you can go to dadsontheair.com.au and send us an email and we'll be in touch. And we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. Simon, just remains for me now to thank you very much for being on the show and providing all that information about Mates for Mates.
Thanks, Bill.
We'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air, but for now, that's goodbye from us, all of us at Dads on the Air.